It was early May, real spring, the time when a young man's fancy is supposed to lightly turn to thoughts of love. A wonderful season, and undoubtedly a great emotion, but Norman Daniels had other things on his mind. He had wanted a break, one little break, and now it had come. It had taken too long, almost 3 goddamn weeks, but it had finally come. He sat on a park bench 800 miles from the place where his wife was currently changing hotel sheets, a big man in a red polo shirt and gray gabardine slacks. In one hand, he held a fluorescent green tennis ball. The muscles of his forearm flexed rhythmically as he squeezed it. A second man came across the street, stood at the edge of the sidewalk, looking into the park, then spotted the man on the bench and began walking toward him. He ducked as a frisbee sailed close by, then stopped short as a large German shepherd charged past him, chasing it. This second man was both younger and slighter than the man on the bench. He had a handsome, unreliable face and a tiny Errol Flynn mustache. He stopped in front of the man with a tennis ball in his right hand and looked at him uncertainly. "Help you, bro?" the man with the tennis ball asked. "Is your name Daniels?" The man with the tennis ball nodded that it was. The man with the Errol Flynn mustache pointed across the street at a new high-rise loaded with glass and angles. "Guy in there told me to come over here and see you. He said maybe you could help me with my problem." "Was it Lieutenant Morelli?" the man with the tennis ball asked. "Yeah, that was his name." "And what problem do you have?" "You know," the man with the Errol Flynn mustache said. "Tell you what, bro. Maybe I do, and maybe I don't. Either way, I'm the man, and you're just a greasy little half-breed cock gobbler with a very troubled life. I think you better tell me what I want to hear, don't you? And what I want to hear right now is what kind of problem you got. Say it right out loud." "I'm up on a dope charge," the man with the Errol Flynn mustache said. He looked sullenly at Daniels. "Sold an 8-ball to a narc." "Oops," the man with the tennis ball said. "That's a felony. It can be a felony anyway, but it gets worse, doesn't it? They found something of mine in your wallet, didn't they?" "Yeah, your fucking bank card, just my luck. Find an ATM card in the trash, it belongs to a fucking cop." "Sit down," Daniel said genially. But when the man with the Errol Flynn mustache started to move to the right side of the bench, the cop shook his head impatiently. "Other side, dickweed, other side." The man with the mustache backtracked, then sat gingerly down on Daniels' left side. He watched as the right hand squeezed the tennis ball in a steady, quick rhythm. Squeeze, squeeze, squeeze. Thick blue veins wriggled up the white underside of the cop's arm like water snakes. The frisbee floated by. The two men watched the German shepherd chase after, its long legs galloping like the legs of a horse. "Beautiful dog," Daniels said. "Shepherds are beautiful dogs. I always like a shepherd, don't you?" "Sure, great," the man with the mustache said, although he actually thought the dog was butt ugly and looked like it would happily chew you a new asshole if you gave it half a chance. "We've got a lot to talk about," the cop with the tennis ball said. "In fact, I think this is going to be one of the most important conversations of your young life, my friend. Are you ready for that?" The man with the mustache swallowed past some sort of blockage in his throat and wished, for about the 800th time that day, that he had gotten rid of the goddamn bank card. Why hadn't he? Why had he been such a total goddamned idiot? Except he knew why he had been such a total goddamned idiot. Because he'd kept thinking that eventually he might figure out a way to use it. Because he was an optimist. This was America, after all, the land of opportunity. Also because, and this was a lot closer to the nub of the truth, he had sort of forgotten that it was there in his wallet, tucked in behind a bunch of business cards he was always picking up. Coke had that effect on you. It kept you running, but you couldn't fucking remember why you were running. The cop was looking at him, and he was smiling, but there was no smile in his eyes. The eyes looked famished. All at once, the man with the mustache felt like one of the three little pigs sitting on a park bench next to the big bad wolf. "Listen, man, I never use your bank card. Let's just get that up front. They told you that, didn't they? I never fucking used it once." "Of course you didn't," The cop said, half laughing, "You couldn't get the PIN number. It's based on my home phone number and my number's unlisted, like most cops. But I bet you already know that, right? I bet you checked." "No," the man with the mustache said. "No, I didn't." He had, of course. He had checked the phone book after trying several different combinations of the street address on the card and the zip code with no luck. He had punched ATM buttons all over the city at first. He had punched buttons until his fingers were sore and he felt like an asshole playing the world's most miserly slot machine. "So, what's going to happen when we check the computer runs on Merchants Bank ATM machines?" the cop asked. "We're not going to find my card in the cancel retry column about a billion times? Hey, if we don't, I'll buy you a steak dinner. What do you think about that, bro?" The man with the mustache didn't know what to think about it or anything else. He was getting a very bad feeling, a bitch of a bad feeling. Meanwhile, the cop's fingers went on working the tennis ball, in and out, in and out, in and out. It was creepy how he never stopped doing that. "Your name's Ramon Sanders," the cop named Daniel said. "You got a rap sheet long as my arm. Theft, con, dope, vice, everything but assault, battery, crimes of that nature. No mixing it up for you, right? You fags don't like getting hit, do you? Even the ones that look like Schwarzenegger. Oh, they don't mind wearing a security t-shirt and flexing their pecs for the limousines in front of some homo club, but if anyone actually starts hitting, you guys go flat in a hurry, don't you?" Ramon Sanders said nothing. It seemed by far the wisest course. "I don't mind hitting," the cop named Daniel said. "Kicking either. Even biting." He spoke almost reflectively. He seemed to be looking both at and beyond the German Shepherd, which was now trotting back in their direction with the frisbee in its mouth. "What do you think of that, Angel Eyes?" Ramon went on saying nothing, and he tried to keep a poker face, but a lot of little lights inside his head were turning red, and a dismaying tingle had begun to shake its way through his nerve tree. His heart was picking up speed, like a train leaving the station and heading into open country. He kept snatching little glances of the big man in the red polo shirt and liking less and less what he saw. The guy's right forearm was totally flexed now, veins fat with blood, muscles popped like freshly risen bread rolls. Daniels didn't seem to mind Ramon's failure to answer. The face he turned toward the smaller man was smiling, or appeared to be smiling, if you ignored the eyes. The eyes were as blank and shiny as two new quarters. "I got good news for you, little hero. You can do the stroll on the dope charge. Give me a little help and you're as free as a bird. Now what do you think about that?" What he thought was that he wanted to go right on keeping his mouth shut, but that no longer seemed like an option. This time the cop wasn't just rolling on. This time he was waiting for an answer. "That's great," Ramon said, hoping he was giving the right one. "That's great, really excellent. Thanks for giving me a break." "Well, maybe I like you, Ramon," the cop said. And then he did an astounding thing, something Ramon never would have expected from a screwhead ex-gyrene like this guy. He plopped his left hand into Ramon's crotch and began giving him a rubdown right out in front of God, the kids on the playground, and anybody who cared to take a look. He slid his hand in a gentle clockwise motion, his palm moving back and forth and up and down over the little patch of flesh, which had more or less run Ramon's life ever since two of his father's buddies, men Ramon was supposed to call Uncle Bill and Uncle Carlo, had taken turns blowing him when he was 9 years old. And what happened next was probably not very extraordinary, although it seemed very fucking bizarre right then. He began to get hard. "Yeah, maybe I like you. Maybe I like you a lot, greasy little cocksucker in shiny black pants and pointy shoes. What's not to like?" The cop kept on giving his cock a shoeshine while he talked. He varied his stroke every now and then, applying a little squeeze that caused Ramon to gasp. "And it's a good thing I like you, Ramon. You better believe it, because they really nailed you this time. Felony bust. But you know what bothers me? Leffingwell and Brewster, the cops who busted you, were laughing in the squad room this morning. They were laughing about you, and that was okay. But I also have this feeling that they were laughing about me, and that's not okay. I don't like for people to laugh about me, and I generally don't put up with it. But this morning I had to, and this afternoon I'm going to be your best friend. I'm going to lose some pretty serious drug charges, even though you had my fucking bank card. Can you guess why? The Frisbee floated by again with the German Shepherd in close pursuit, but this time Ramon Sanders barely saw it. He was stiff as a rail spike under the cop's hand and as scared as a mouse under the claws of a cat. The hand squeezed harder this time, and Ramon uttered a hoarse little howl. His cafe au lait skin was running with sweat. His mustache looked like a dead earthworm after a hard rain. Can you guess, Ramon? No, Ramon said. Because the woman who ditched the card was my wife, Daniel said. That's mostly why Leffingwell and Brewster were laughing. That's my deduction. She takes my bank card. She uses it to draw a few $100 out of the bank, money I earned, and when the card turns up again, it's in the possession of a greasy little spick cocksucker named Ramon. No wonder they're laughing. Please, Ramon wanted to say, please don't hurt me. I'll tell you anything, but please don't hurt me. He wanted to say those things, but he couldn't say a word, not one. His asshole had contracted until it felt roughly the size of an inner tube valve. The big cop leaned closer to him, close enough so that Ramon could smell cigarettes and scotch on his breath. Now that I've shared with you, I want you to share with me. The rubbing stopped, and strong fingers curled around Ramon's testes through the thin fabric of his slacks. The shape of his erect penis was clear above the cop's hand. It looked like one of those toy bats you could buy at a baseball park souvenir stand. Ramon could feel the strength in that hand. And you better share the right thing, Ramon. Do you know why? Ramon shook his head numbly. He felt as if someone had turned on a warm water tap somewhere in his body, and his entire skin was leaking. Daniels extended his right hand, the one with the tennis ball, until it was under Ramon's nose. Then he closed his hand with a sudden vicious snap. There was a pop and a brief, harsh whisper. Fwah! As his fingers punched through the ball's furry, fluorescent skin. The ball collapsed inward, then turned halfway inside out. I can do that with my left hand, too, Daniel said. Do you believe that? Ramon tried to say he did, and found he still couldn't talk. He nodded instead. Will you keep it in mind? Ramon nodded again. Okie doke. So, now, here's what I want you to tell me, Ramon. I know you're just a stinking little spick rump wrangler who doesn't know much about women, except maybe for fucking your mother up the ass in your younger years. You just got that motherfucker look about you somehow. But you go on and use your imagination. How do you think it feels to come home and find out that your wife, the woman who promised to love, honor, and fucking obey you, has run off with your bank card? How do you think it feels to find out she used it to pay for her fucking vacation and then she stuffed it in a bus terminal garbage can for a greasy little penis vacuum like you to find? Not too good, Ramon whispered. I bet it don't feel too good. Please don't hurt me, officer. Please don't. Daniels slowly tightened his hand, tightened it until the tendons in his wrist stood out like the strings on a guitar. A wave of pain, heavy as liquid lead, rolled into Ramon's belly, and he tried to scream. Nothing came out but a hoarse exhalation. Not too good? Daniels whispered in his face. His breath was warm and steamy and boozy and cigarette-y. Is that the best you can do? What a fucking numbnuts you are. Still, I guess it's not an entirely wrong answer either. The hand loosened, but only a little. Ramon's lower belly was a lake of agony, but his penis was as hard as ever. He had never been into pain. Whatever drove the bondage freaks was totally beyond him. And he could only suppose he still had a hard-on because the blood in his cock was trapped there by the heel of the cop's hand. He swore to himself that if he got out of this alive, he would go directly to St. Patrick's and say 50 Hail Marys. 50. 150. They're laughing at me in there, the cop said, lifting his chin in the direction of the brand new cop shop across the street. They're laughing, all right. Oh, yeah. Big, tough Norman Daniels, and guess what? His wife ran out on him, but she took the time to clean out most of the ready before she went. Daniels made an inarticulate growling sound, the sort of sound that a person should only have to hear while visiting the zoo, and gave Ramon's balls another squeeze. The pain was unbearable. He leaned forward and vomited between his knees, white chunks of curd laced with brown streaks that was probably the remains of the quesadilla he had eaten for lunch. Daniels did not seem to notice. He was gazing into the sky above the jungle gym, lost in his own world. "I should let them dance you around so even more people can laugh?" he asked. "So that they can yuck it up at the courthouse as well as at the police station? I don't think so." He turned and looked into Ramon's eyes. He smiled. The smile made Ramon want to scream. "Here comes the big question," the cop said. "And if you lie, little hero, I'm going to rip your scrot off and feed it to you." Daniel squeezed Ramon's crotch again, and now folds of darkness began to fall across Ramon's vision. He fought them desperately. If he passed out, the cop was apt to kill him just for spite. "Do you understand what I'm saying?"
"Yes," Ramon wept. "I understand. I understand."
"You were at the bus station, and you saw her stick the card in the trash. That much I know. What I need to know is where she went next." Ramon could have wept with relief because, although there was no reason why he should be able to answer this question, it just so happened he could. He had looked after the woman once to make sure she wasn't looking back at him, and then, 5 minutes later, long after he had slid the green plastic card into his wallet, he had spotted her again. She had been hard to miss with that red thing over her hair. It was as bright as the side of a freshly painted barn.
"She was at the ticket windows," Ramon cried out of the darkness that was relentlessly enveloping him. "At the windows!"
This effort was rewarded by another ruthless squeeze. Ramon began to feel as if his balls had been torn open, doused with lighter fluid, and then set on fire.
"I know she was at the windows," Daniels half laughed, half screamed at him. "What else would she be doing at Portside if she wasn't going someplace on a bus, doing a sociological study on scumbuckets like you? Which ticket window? That's what I want to know, which fucking window and what fucking time?"
And oh, thank God, thank Jesus and Mother Mary, he knew the answers to both of those questions, too.
"Continental Express," he cried, now separated from his own voice by what felt like miles. "I seen her at the Continental Express window, 10:30, 10:45.
"Continental? You're sure?" Ramon Sanders didn't answer. He collapsed sideways on the bench, one hand dangling, slim fingers outstretched. His face was dead white except for two small purplish patches high on his cheeks. A young man and a young woman walked by, looked at the man lying on the bench, then looked at Daniels, who had by now removed his hand from Ramon's crotch.
"Don't worry," Daniels said, giving the couple a large smile. "He's epileptic."
He paused and let his smile widen. "I'll take care of him. I'm a cop." They walked on a little faster and didn't look back. Daniels got an arm around Ramon's shoulders. The bones in there felt as fragile as birds' wings. "Upsy-daisy, big boy," he said, and hauled Ramon up to a sitting position. Ramon's head lolled like the head of a flower on a broken stalk. He started to slide back down immediately, making little thick grunts in his throat. Daniels hauled him up again, and this time Ramon balanced. Daniels sat there beside him, watching the German Shepherd race joyfully after the Frisbee. He envied dogs. He really did. They had no responsibilities, no need to work. Not in this country, anyhow. All food was provided for them, plus a place to sleep, and they didn't even have to worry about heaven or hell when the ride was over. He had once asked Father O'Brien back in Aubreyville about that, and Father had told him that pets had no souls. When they died, they just winked out like 4th of July sparklers. It was true that the Shep had probably lost his balls, not even 6 months after he was born, but in a way, that's a blessing, too, Daniels murmured. He patted Ramon's crotch, where the penis was now deflating, even as the testicles began to swell. "Right, big boy?" Ramon muttered deep in his throat. It was the sound of a man having a terrible dream. Still, Daniels thought, what you got was what you got, and so you might as well be content with it. He might be lucky enough to be a German Shepherd in his next life, with nothing to do but chase frisbees in the park and stick his head out of the back window of the car on his way home to a nice big supper of Purina dog chow,
But in this one, he was a man with a man's problems. At least he was a man, unlike his little buddy. Continental Express. Ramon had seen her at the Continental Express ticket window at 10:30 or 10:45, and she wouldn't have waited long. She was too scared of him to wait for long. He'd bet his life on that. So he was looking for a bus that had left Portside between, say, 11 in the morning and 1 in the afternoon, probably headed for a large city where she felt she could lose herself. "But you can't do that," Daniel said. He watched the Shep jump and snatch the frisbee out of the air with its long white teeth. No, she couldn't do that. She might think she could, but she was wrong. He would work on it weekends to start with, mostly using the phone. He would have to do it that way. There was a lot going on at the company store, a big bust coming down, his bust if he was lucky. But that was all right. He'd be ready to turn his full attention to Rose soon enough, and before long she was going to regret what she had done. Yes, she was going to regret it for the rest of her life, a period of time which might be short, but which would be extremely, well, extremely intense, he said out loud, and yes, that was the right word, exactly the right word. He got up and walked briskly back toward the street and the police station on the other side, not wasting a second glance on the semi-conscious young man sitting on the bench with his head down and his hands laced limply together in his crotch. In Detective Inspector Second Grade Norman Daniels's mind, Ramon had ceased to exist. Daniels was thinking about his wife and all the things she had to learn, about all the things they had to talk about, and they would talk about them, just as soon as he tracked her down. All sorts of things. Ships and sails and sealing wax, not to mention what should happen to wives who promised to love, honor, and obey, and then took a powder with their husband's bank cards in their purses. All those things. They would talk about them up close.
She was making another bed, but this time it was all right. It was a different bed, in a different room, in a different city. Best of all, this was a bed she had never slept in and never would. A month had passed since she had left the house 800 miles east of here, and things were a lot better. Currently, her worst problem was her back, and even that was getting better, she was sure of it. Right now, the ache around her kidneys was strong and unpleasant, true enough, but this was her 18th room of the day. And when she'd begun at the Whitestone, she'd been close to fainting after a dozen rooms, and unable to go on after 14. She'd had to ask Pam for help. 4 weeks could make a hell of a difference in a person's outlook, Rosie was discovering, especially if it was 4 weeks without any hard shots to the kidneys or the pit of the stomach. Still, for now it was enough. She went to the hall door, poked her head out, and looked in both directions. She saw nothing but a few room service trays left over from breakfast, Pam's trolley down by the Lake Michigan suite at the end of the hall, and her own trolley out here in front of 624. Rosie lifted a pile of fresh washcloths stacked on the end of the trolley, exposing a banana. She took it, walked back across the room to the overstuffed chair by 624's window, and sat down. She peeled a piece of fruit and began to eat it slowly, looking out at the lake, which glimmered like a mirror on this still, rainy afternoon in May. Her heart and mind were filled with a huge, simple emotion. Gratitude. Her life wasn't perfect, at least not yet, but it was better than she ever would have believed on that day in mid-April when she had stood on the porch of Daughters and Sisters, looking at the intercom box and the keyhole that had been filled with metal. At that moment, she had seen nothing in the future but darkness and misery. Now her kidneys hurt and her feet hurt, and she was very aware that she did not want to spend the rest of her life as an off-the-books chambermaid in the Whitestone Hotel. But the banana tasted good, and the chair felt wonderful beneath her. At that moment, she would not have traded her place in the scheme of things for anyone's. In the weeks since she had left Norman, Rosie had become exquisitely aware of small pleasures. Reading for half an hour before bed, talking with some of the other women about movies or TV shows as they did the supper dishes together, or taking 5 minutes off to sit down and eat a banana. It was also wonderful to know what was coming next, and to feel sure it wasn't going to include something sudden and painful. To know, for instance, that there were only two more rooms to go, and then she and Pam could go down in the service elevator and out the back door. On the way to the bus stop, she was now able to differentiate easily between orange, red, and blue line buses. They would probably pop into the hot pot for coffee. Simple things, simple pleasures. The world could be good. She supposed she had known that as a child, but she had forgotten. Now she was learning it over again, and it was a sweet lesson. She didn't have all she wanted, not by any means, but she had enough for now, especially since she didn't know what the rest might be. That would have to wait until she was out of daughters and sisters. But she had a feeling she would be moving soon, probably the next time a room turned up vacant on what the residents at DNS called Anna's List. A shadow fell across the open hotel doorway, and before she could even think where she might hide her half-eaten banana, let alone get to her feet, Pam poked her head in. "Peek, baby," she said, and giggled when Rosie jumped. "Don't ever do that, Pam. You almost gave me a heart attack." "Ah, they'd never fire you for sitting down and eating a banana," Pam said. "You should see some of the stuff that goes on in this place." "What have you got left? 22 and 20? "Yes." "Want some help?" "Oh, you don't have to." "I don't mind," Pam said. "Really, with two of us on the case, we can turn those two rooms in 15 minutes. What do you say?"
"I say yes," Rosie told her gratefully. "And I'm buying at the hot pot after work. Pie as well as coffee, if you want."
Pam grinned. "If they've got any of that chocolate cream, I want, believe me." Good days. 4 weeks of good days, give or take. That night, as she lay on her cot with her hands laced behind her head, looking into the darkness and listening to the woman who had come in the previous evening, sobbing quietly 2 or 3 cots down on her left, Rosie thought that the days were mostly good for a negative reason. There was no Norman in them. She sensed, however, that it would soon take more than his absence to satisfy and fulfill her. "Not quite yet, though," she thought, and closed her eyes. "For now, what I've got is still plenty. These simple days of work, food, sleep, and no Norman Daniels." She began to drift, to come untethered from her conscious mind, and in her head, Carole King once again started to sing the lullaby that sent her off to sleep most nights. "I'm really Rosie, and I'm Rosie real. You better believe me, I'm a great big deal." Then there was darkness, and a night they were becoming more frequent when there were no bad dreams. Providence. When Rosie and Pam Haverford came down in the service elevator after work on the following Wednesday, Pam looked pale and unwell. "Oh, it's my period," she said when Rosie expressed concern. "I'm having cramps like a bastard. Do you want to stop for a coffee?" Pam thought about it, then shook her head. "You go on without me. All I want to do right now is go back to DNS and find an empty bedroom before everyone shows up from work and starts yakking. Gobble some My Doll and sleep for a couple of hours. If I do that, maybe I'll feel like a human being again." "I'll come with you," Rosie said as the elevator doors opened and they stepped out. Pam shook her head. "No, you don't," she said, and her face lit in a brief smile. "I can make it on my own. I'm just fine. And you're old enough to have a cup of coffee without a chaperone. Who knows? You might even meet someone interesting." Rosie sighed. To Pam, someone interesting always meant a man, usually the kind with muscles that stood out under their form-fitting T-shirts like geological landmarks. And as far as Rosie was concerned, she could do without that kind of man for the rest of her life. Besides, she was married. She glanced down at her wedding band and diamond engagement ring inside it as they stepped out onto the street. How much that glance had to do with what happened a short time later was something of which she was never sure. But it did place the engagement ring, which in the ordinary course of things she hardly ever thought of at all, somewhere toward the front of her mind. It was a little over a carat, by far the most expensive thing her husband had ever given her, and until that day the idea that it belonged to her, and she could dispose of it if she wanted to, and in any way she wanted to, had never crossed her mind. Rosie waited at the bus stop around the corner from the hotel with Pam, in spite of Pam's protestations that it was totally unnecessary. She really didn't like the way Pam looked, with all the color gone from her cheeks and dark smudges under her eyes and little pain lines running down from the corners of her mouth. Besides,